In this episode of Startups the Recipes, Rob and I are going to be answering questions about tools for testing sales funnels, reseller strategies, and integration marketing. This is Startups the Recipes, episode 154. Welcome to Startups with Recipes, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products. Whether you built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made.
So I have some good news and some bad news. The good news is Drip launched to 600 more people today. Nothing's broken so far. People are signing up for trials. Things look good. The bad news is that Google has announced that they're going for 100% not provided keywords. They're trying to go to 100% of not sending keywords through to your website so that you don't know how people are finding you organically. And of course, they dropped some hint about, we want to protect everybody from the NSA. But in fact, if you actually buy the same keywords through Google AdWords, they will tell you the keywords that you're using, you know, people are using to find you. So sounds like more of a money grab than anything. The reason it's bad for me is that this impacts Hittail. Basically, Hittail relies on those keywords, and that's part of the data that it uses to give you back suggestions. So what I've been seeing, I kind of panicked when I heard about this, and I thought, oh man, Hittail's done. If they hit 100%, Hittail really doesn't have much value. But what I've noticed is that there's been a steady, slow decline over the past 6 to 12 months across all sites, and my sites included, of the not provided thing ratcheting up. And so my churn rate hasn't increased. With my own sites, we still get plenty of suggestions, and we fill the blog with long tail keyword suggestions. So as of today, even though I have sites that are literally at 90%+ not provided, I'm still able to use Hittail and get value out of it. It's not as much value as I got 12 months ago, but as long as it doesn't abruptly go to 100%, I actually think that Hittail can stick around, at least in the short term, and potentially a little bit further out than that. So that's been my day, launching a new one and then seeing another one kind of get hammered by that. It's that third-party integration, right? It may not be an API that we're using, but for all intents, anyone at any time can kind of pull the rug out from under you if you're relying on their data.
Yeah, I mean, that's not even an integration. I mean, that's just an outright reliance on them. So that totally sucks. I mean, reading that they started doing this back in 2011, I would think that they've been heavily testing this a lot over the past couple of years, in part probably to start shutting down some of the companies that are doing SEO. I can't imagine any other reason why they would be doing it other than to basically make more money off of AdWords, because they want people to use ads. They want people to click on those things. And when people are doing all sorts of organic SEO, then they don't need those paid advertisements anymore, because their search engine is good enough that it's showing people the results that they want, that their algorithm has determined are the best results out there. So it makes sense that they would want to obscure that so that people start having to buy AdWords, because their traditional SEO quote unquote tricks don't work anymore.
Right. And Google kind of did a 1-2 punch. And the second part of the punch is that they went out and blocked all the scrapers. So, if you're doing SEO, you typically use a rank tracker, something like SERPFox. But it basically tells you, you enter a bunch of keywords and you enter your website, and it tells you where you rank for those. And Google used to have an API for that, and they shut that down a couple years ago. Then these companies were scraping to figure out your rank, and now they've blocked them. So they're really, rapidly going after SEO. And they also shut down, I think, another couple of blog networks, like big link farms, they call them. The death of SEO has been coming for a long time. It's been a slow plod forward. And if Google didn't own so much of the search landscape, I think other search engines would step up. And as far as I know, still Bing and the other search engines, they don't do really any of this stuff. They don't block the stuff, but they just aren't enough of the market to really make a difference.
Got it. On my end, I just finalized a massive upgrade of Audit Shark over the past couple of days. The servers are finally running Windows 2012 at this point. Everything's now on the .NET 4.5 framework, and all the bugs that I had talked about a couple of weeks ago are completely out of the picture. Basically, all the ones that were associated with the upgrade have all been dealt with. So I'm really pleased about that progress, and at this point, it looks like I'm going to be going to the early access customers and working through the process with them. But everything I'm looking at so far basically says that things are ready and good to go. It's just a matter of hitting that early access list and working through people and making sure that they're getting the value out of it. And, you know, just kind of iterating similar to how you're doing things. I'll probably be a lot more hesitant, I'll say. I'm certainly not going to be emailing 600 people at a time, because there's a lot of traffic that comes in from some of the different components, and I want to make sure that the infrastructure can fully support it, because that's one of the things that hasn't been, I'd say, adequately tested. So I'll be onboarding people at a much lower rate than I think you are.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you recall, I started off with one customer, and then I brought one customer on at a time until we had 20 people using the system, and that took me 6 weeks to do. So I think you're at that stage. Then we fixed a bunch of stuff, added features based on their responses. By the end of that, I had about 9 paying customers, almost $500 in revenue. And then that's when I decided to email that first 300 batch. And we did upgrade, you know, the database server. We split the web server into 2. You know, we did some little bit of scaling stuff that took, I mean, literally 1 or 2 hours to do, because with all the virtual stuff, it's easy. And I think you're, you know, headed towards that at this point. Because you're right, I never would have emailed 600 people 3 or 4 months ago, because I just didn't have the confidence that we could handle it. And I think, to be honest, I think that's both from a technology perspective, but it's also just from your processes. Like, you need to make sure you're answering support emails in a timely manner. How hard is onboarding? Can you walk people through individually? Do you have your trial emails that go out, or are you sending those manually? Because I did that manually early on. Do you have automated billing? You know, there's a lot of things that if you don't have them in place yet, that's another thing that doesn't scale yet if you don't have the code written.
Yeah, that's definitely right. And I there are some of those things that I've got automated and some of them I don't. So for the time being, I have to send out things manually. The code for billing hasn't been fully tested yet. So I want to run those things manually for a little while until we get to a point where I've gone through them and said, okay, I feel like we've covered 80 or 90% of the different scenarios that could possibly come up where something could go wrong. And at that point, just add in some extra error handling and make sure nothing's going to go wrong. Or maybe even just set it up so that it sends me an email and says, here's a summary. Please click on this link, go into the dashboard, and then click the run button to just go through and actually do the billing for everybody. But I do want to be careful about a lot of stuff like that. And as you said, until you get to a certain point, I mean, you don't want to just blast a ton of people in there, because you're going to overload yourself with either support or all these other problems.
All right. Very good. Well, congratulations again. So you have one paying customer, and you basically said you're done with remediation and the UI and now a technology upgrade. And so you're going to start moving into contact and early access folks.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. I subscribed to Patrick McKenzie's email newsletter, and he sent something out within the last week that relates back to a conversation that we had and that Dave had actually called in about, and he left a voicemail. And was basically talking about getting that payment up front versus just getting a commitment to pay up front. And Patrick reminded me that Jason Cohen at MicroConf had said, I think it's going to cost $30 a month. Will you write me a check for the first month right now to reserve your place? I won't cash it until we deliver. And so Jason had taken a slightly different tact, which was getting a commitment up front and actually getting a check, but he wasn't taking the money. And that kind of goes back to our discussion of us saying the important thing is to get the commitment. I think if you actually need the money to build the product, this is not a good approach, right? Because you're not supposed to cash this check. You should have the money to build the product on your own. And if you don't, I don't think this is the way to get it.
My favorite part of that entire email was, and I'll quote him word for word. Patrick says, my favorite symptom of an unmet need for software is any Excel spreadsheet which is ever updated by one employee, sent to a second employee, updated, and then sent back. Every time that happens, a SaaS angel gets its wings.
Very nice.
That reminds me of a comment that we got on episode 138 from Sean, who said, as you're doing your research, if you come across anyone that's using a spreadsheet as a tracking tool, that's a big signal you've got an opportunity to build something that can do it better.
Yeah, I heard this, I think, at Business of Software a couple years ago. I like this approach. I also like the approach, which is another one I heard at a conference, of look at the big enterprise tools where there is no lower price SaaS version and see what pieces of that you can break off and turn into a lower priced but self-service version of it. And so you don't have the long sales cycles. You try to bring it down to the small and medium-sized business market instead of the enterprise market. And there's a ton of apps that have done that. I mean, you think of all the accounting apps. You think of the kind of CRM apps that used to only be $1 million and now they're SaaS versions. You see even email marketing apps at first were very, very expensive. And then Constant Contact came with a $39 a month version. So I think there are still some fruit. I don't know if it's low hanging, but those are interesting ways to generate ideas, is looking at both enterprise apps and then ways that folks are using Excel spreadsheets.
Something else that ties into that is most people are very familiar with Excel, but I've seen a lot of applications written over the top of Access databases. So I think that that's probably another good place where if you find anybody who's got a Access program that, you know, has been customized or has been outsourced to some consulting company who came in and built something for them to track different information, that's another place where you can probably look for a product to build. And I think the one thing to be a little bit careful of is that when you get into those types of things, it's a much bigger commitment on the part of the company to bring somebody in to build that for them. So chances are the complexity is going to be a lot higher than they had with an Excel spreadsheet. But I still think that it's, you know, at least worth exploring and asking questions about.
So you also had a little shift in your marketing focus this week. What happened?
I actually cut back on my Facebook advertising just because I didn't have time to pay attention to it. Facebook was, they were sending clicks through, but they weren't necessarily converting as well as I would have liked. But because I didn't have the time to follow up on it to try and figure out exactly what was happening, I basically just killed it dead in the water for a little while until I could come back to it. Because we were, as I said, we were working on that massive upgrade of the Audit Shark infrastructure, and I just didn't want to be throwing money away. So instead of doing that, I just said, okay, well, I'll kill this for a little while.
Yeah, a little known fact about paid acquisition is there's a lot of upfront time investment honing it to make it actually work. And then even once it works, you still need ongoing maintenance because the ads burn out. Some people call it ad rot. But it basically, the click-through rates will go down over time, period. I've never seen a system where that doesn't happen, especially with visual ads like this. So yeah, it's probably a good idea to cut back on them, but you're going to start them up again. I imagine that there's still a lucrative market out there. Are you planning to start it up in the next week or two?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be doing it later this week. I've still got a bunch of different phrases that I want to try. I want to swap out some of the images and, you know, just try some different mechanisms for, you know, saying the same types of things, but in a different way. Trying to reach different audiences, going into different target markets, that sort of thing.
Very good. So we're answering some listener questions today.
That's right. So the first one that we have is from Carl Falconer. And he says, hey guys, thanks for all your work creating the podcast. I've recently been attending a local lunch and learn series on financial literacy for startups. I'd be interested in learning how you both manage the business accounting, not necessarily the tax accounting of your products. For example, things like balance sheets, cash flow, etc. What's the decision-making process behind your financial models? With all of your experience, have you become better at predicting your break-even point? Thanks, Carl.
So with a software company, I like to keep it very simple. And in fact, I don't look at my balance sheet ever. Aside from cash on hand, that's pretty much all I would look at as an asset. I like to keep things simple. I like to focus on the business rather than this kind of stuff, the business accounting aspect of it. I know that if I was running a business with inventory or with accounts receivable where you invoice and get paid net 30, you need to look at that stuff. You need to look at cash flow. But for me, the cash flow comes in virtually instantly. The biggest delay I have is with Stripe, which is a 7-day delay from when I get paid. So as long as I have enough cash in the bank, it's literally a rounding error and it doesn't matter. So the thing that I look at with my business accounting is the income statement. And all that is all my revenue, all my expenses, and I can just look top to bottom and see what came in that month, look at anything that's kind of funky. I know the rule of thumb. You can set a budget physically in the accounting app, or I know rule of thumb where I should be, and if something looks out of whack, I'll go in and investigate. Realistically, software companies tend to be, especially SaaS apps like this, tend to be really cash heavy. You're not typically at a danger of expelling more cash than that's coming in once you've reached profitability. Frankly, I just treat it as kind of a simple cash in, cash out business. And the packages that I've used are Outright. That's typically the one I use for the simpler businesses I have. And then I use Xero, which is xero.com. And that's for the more complicated scenarios. And as Mike and I have talked about over the last couple months, we both have bookkeepers now. And that's actually been a godsend because it just saves me quite a bit of time getting these things organized each month.
primary difference between me and you is that I use some of the different tools. I use Less Accounting for one business, and then I use QuickBooks for the other. And just like you, I mean, I don't pay attention too much to anything like balance sheets or accounts receivables or anything like that. And, you know, the biggest thing is just how much money has come in over the past 30 days and how much money I'm spending on some of the different services. And that can vary from one month to the next. Occasionally, I'll go in to try and identify where all of my money is going so that I know, at least periodically review whether or not there are services that I'm just no longer using anymore and whether or not I need to cut them. But I actually have some services that I've been using for a while that I just continue paying for them because it's actually more of a hassle to go in and cancel those accounts than it is to just say, oh, well, it's only $5 or $10 a month or whatever. And in terms of predicting a break-even point, I don't even think that that comes into mind. Do you think about that at all or no?
Not really. I basically set goals of where I want to grow revenue each month. That's the one number that I look at, while keeping in mind that I want to acquire customers for substantially less than their lifetime value. As long as I'm doing that, I know that the business is going to be profitable down the line. I don't think about the break even. I think about, I want revenue to be at X $1,000 30 days from now. And those are the goals that I'm shooting to hit. And the break even just kind of comes along with that.
So thanks for the question, Carl. Our next question comes from Henry Oswald, and he says, I'm currently trying to measure my sales funnels and could do with some technical guidance. I'm sure many are in the same boat. Could you elaborate on which tools you use to measure your funnel and or A/B test things? How do you measure which traffic sources convert? Which three things would you recommend you measure for a new site? It feels like this is something everyone says you should do, but rarely say how you should do it. Thanks in advance, Henry.
All right. So here's how you should do it. In terms of which tools do we use to measure, I use Google Analytics because it's free. I use Kissmetrics because it provides a little more detailed information, but it's quite expensive. I think it's $150 a month is the kind of the low end plan. And then for split testing, I use what it used to be Google Website Optimizer. They've now integrated it into Google Analytics. And you can get by if you don't have a high budget. Analytics, there are solid tools for split testing like Visual Website Optimizer and Optimizely. Again, I think those are started around $100 a month. So depends on where your budget is and, you know, do you have more money than time at this point or not? Your second question is, how do you measure which traffic sources convert? You can easily set up a Google Analytics goal for any type of conversion that you want. Just Google how to do that. I mean, it'll take you 2 minutes to do. You do it based on the URL someone hits, or you just slap a little JavaScript on a page, on your receipt page. Again, you can also use Kissmetrics for this. Again, I use both and check back and forth. And then finally, you said, which first three things would you recommend you measure for a new website? I'm assuming this is a software or a SaaS website. And so here's the three things I would look at. One is your visit to trial conversion ratio. Second is your trial to paid conversion ratio. And the third is, since you should have like a drip email sequence running, I would look at visit to drip email sequence conversion and then from that sequence into your trial conversion.
Well, personally, similar to you, I use Google Analytics and then I also use Kissmetrics. So in terms of the tools I use, I don't think that there's a whole lot different there. The other thing that I've used is it's a C# framework for doing A/B testing called Fairly Certain. Last I checked, there was a bug in it. It wasn't actually doing the A/B test properly. So if you did an A/B test, the visitor would see the A-type test no matter which page they went on. So if you were running two different tests, they would only see the A version of test one, and they would only ever see the A version of test two. So as far as I know, that's a bug in there that I don't know whether they fixed it or not. I actually went into the code and fixed it myself so that it was random between them. So if you were running more than one A-B test on your site, it just wasn't necessarily giving you the correct results. And that's something you do have to be careful about no matter what A-B testing tool you're using, because you want to make sure that those results are accurate. So do some testing on your own. Make sure that it is giving you the right results. In terms of the three things I would recommend measuring for a new site kind of implies that it's a new piece of software that you've unleashed. And for those types of things, you want to be careful about running A/B tests when you don't actually have enough incoming traffic. I think Rob did a really good job of talking about the things that you should definitely be measuring, but I would be very, very cautious about running A/B tests when you don't have enough traffic to justify those A/B tests. If you're not going to get a statistically significant result, then you don't want to be running those tests because they're going to be giving you misleading information. So Henry, thanks for the question. Our next one comes from Dylan, and he says, "Hi, Rob and Mike. I'm trying to come up with a reseller strategy and would love to hear your thoughts. My bootstrapped product called ActivityBook is an HR enterprise application which requires a private VM, so it's not strictly a SaaS application. Sales are fairly high touch at the moment, using cold calling and face-to-face. I have several clients on trial, including HR service providers, who want the product deployed for each of their clients to be used as an HR portal. The HR service providers will, in effect, become resellers. In addition to these, I've been approached by other companies who have asked for reseller programs. This is all great, but I'm struggling with a reseller strategy that's attractive to both parties. Pricing is confusing. Should I give a percentage of the lifetime of the client, just the initial sale, or a depreciating percentage during the lifetime? Should I allow them to charge whatever they like as long as I get my fee? I'm also considering white labeling, allowing the reseller to run training courses and their own configuration services, etc. What do you guys think? Do you offer reseller packages or know of anyone who has an attractive reseller package? In closing, I'm a longtime listener and believe my product has got to the point it is right now due to the inspiration from you guys. If it wasn't for you two and Seth Godin, I'd have no product. Thanks, Dylan."
Well, geez, thanks for the mention next to Seth Godin. That's a very, very high compliment. So it's a little different with a reseller and affiliate, right? Because an affiliate typically is just directing traffic over to your site, and you're basically paying them a percentage. And resellers are often value added, right? They're actually doing some installation. They should do support, upfront support for you. And so they should tend, in general, they will get a higher cut for doing that. The other thing the reseller brings is they have their own network of typically of clients, either existing ones or new ones they're bringing in. And so that's typically how I think about the difference between affiliates and resellers, in case you're listening to this wondering what that might look like. So he asked a couple questions here. The first one was about pricing. He said, "Should I give a percentage of the lifetime of the client, just the initial sale, or a depreciating percentage during the lifetime?" My thoughts on this, and they're not highly experienced, is that I would give them a percentage of the lifetime of the client, but not upfront. Assuming you are charging a monthly maintenance fee, there's nothing more attractive to a business than having recurring revenue. And most businesses don't have that. So you can give a much, much smaller percentage of that recurring revenue, say 10 or 20%. But that's an annuity for that business. And if they're not used to that, it really can be crazy. The lifetime value to them can be worth a lot. On the flip side, if you were to say, okay, you know, all the upfront charges, the setup fees, they all go to you. So maybe they get 100% of the setup fees in the first month, and then you get everything after that. That's an okay deal for them. Personally, if I were in their shoes, I would prefer the recurring. So maybe that is something that you need to feel a couple of them out about and figure out if, you know, which way you should go. But I would lean towards giving them a portion of that recurring sale.
I actually disagree with you, and here's why. So when you have to remember that when you're dealing with resellers of the size that my assumption is these resellers are going to be, I mean, they're an HR service provider, so they probably have 50, 100, 200 employees, probably even more. When you start getting into those types of companies, they have dedicated sales reps. So the problem you're going to run into is that I don't know what your software actually sells for, but let's say that it's $500 a month and you're going to give them, you know, 20% of the sale like Rob suggested. Well, the problem is that $500, if they're going to get 20% of the sale, that means that the company is going to get $100 a month, which to you and me sounds, you know, like a reasonable deal, but at the same time, they have sales reps to pay. So if that sales rep looks at it and says, well, why should I sell this software package for $500 a month to customer X when I could sell them $25,000 worth of consulting services and make my numbers for the quarter? Those are the things that you have to keep in mind when you're going to go down this path, because it's ultimately the sales reps who are going to be trying to, you know, resell your product, not the business. So although you're giving them $100 a month in recurring revenue, it's not necessarily going to go to the sales reps. The sales rep is not adequately compensated to actually go do that. So that's something I'd be really, really careful about.
Got it. So you would lean towards trying to have a larger upfront fee and then basically giving perhaps a huge chunk of that, maybe even 100% of it, to the company with the hopes that they would then split that with the sales rep and they'd have more motivation.
Possibly. I would go talk to these companies and find out exactly how their sales reps are compensated and how they're going to be selling it. And you may very well need to work out several different types of reseller agreements with your first several resellers to figure out what's going to work best and which ones are going to do it. Because, you know, you can take our advice and do one thing and then find out, you know, 2-3 years down the road that it's really just not working. What you need to do is try out a couple of different ones and figure out which one is going to work the best. And maybe you tell them up front, hey, let's try this and we'll reevaluate in 6 months and try and figure out from there whether or not this is appropriate, whether or not your sales reps are actually going to sell it, and figure out what's going to work for both of you. And I think that if you approach it from that angle and tell the company up front, look, we're trying to figure this out just as much as you are in terms of reseller. The other thing I'd be cautious about is letting them push you into any specific way of doing things, because they may ask you to do something that you may not necessarily be comfortable with, but they say, well, let's just try it. And, you know, you get backed into a corner and it turns out that it's just, you know, absolutely fantastic for them. Maybe they're taking all the top line revenue and they're just sending you, you know, the monthly fee, which may very well be what you want. But just be cautious going down the road that they're not pushing you around as well.
Right. So you lean towards saying that you're trying to figure it out as much as they are, and that you want to do a short trial and maybe try to do one or two sales at this rate and then determine later if you need to adjust it, that kind of thing.
Kind of. I mean, I wouldn't limit it to just one or two sales. I mean, I would probably give it a time limited basis, like 5 or 6 months or something like that. And then throughout the course of that 6 months, if you have, let's say, 5 different resellers and one of them brings in 25 sales and the other one only brings in one, well, you have to go to the reseller that only brought in one sale and say, hey, I have another reseller who brought in 25 sales. They're about the same size as you. What is it that you're doing that's different from them? And try and figure it out from that perspective and say, I want to help you guys sell more, but unless, you know, either I understand how you're doing things or am able to compare them between you and another customer, then it's very difficult for you to help them. And it's a very non-confrontational way of addressing what would eventually be a problem, because, you know, down the road, if they come to you and say, oh, well, we've got this huge customer we're trying to land, and they can just become a time sink for you. And if they're not landing sales, then you're going to end up spending time with them walking through pre-sales things, because it is an enterprise sale, and you're just not going to get anything out of it. So you want to be able to compare people and make sure you don't end up in that situation.
What do you think about the second part of his question? He says, should I allow them to charge whatever they like as long as I get my fee?
That's a tough one, because with larger companies, they tend to tack on services. I know that there are certain hardware providers out there who they'll bundle not just hardware and software, but they'll bundle services into price quotes. And it can be a little bit difficult to figure out how much of the cost is going to software, how much is going to hardware, how much is going to services. And you're in a slightly different situation where there's a private VM, so it's just a virtual machine that you deliver digitally. So there's no hardware directly associated with it, but there's, you know, obviously the customer has to have the hardware to run it. I would definitely try to understand how it is that they do their services and what their general pricing looks like before you start making decisions about whether or not you're going to just take a flat rate or not. The other thing to take into consideration is if you try to be too greedy, they may very well try to emulate exactly what you're doing and have somebody else go out and build it as a platform for themselves that they can then leverage for basically for free. So you don't want to get too greedy, but at the same time, you don't want them overstepping their bounds either.
Yeah, I have a tough time with allowing them to charge whatever they like, because then that means you're leaving the price elasticity on the table. Your business isn't going to grow. If it's an enterprise product, the idea is that you're going to make the most money, a big chunk of your revenue from the higher end sales. And if other people are skimming that off the top, then I just don't think your business is going to grow as fast as if you were to kind of keep a control over the ultimate price. The last piece of his question, he says, I'm also considering white labeling, allowing the reseller to run training courses and their own configuration services, etc.
Well, I mean, this ties a little bit back to the previous one. The thing is, allowing them to charge whatever they like is probably not a bad thing, because if they're charging whatever they like, theoretically, you're offering the same product to reseller one as you are to reseller two. The primary difference is that they're offering different services to their customer. Even if you have two resellers who go after the same customer, theoretically, they're offering your service on the back end, and you're going to get paid whether either one sells it. So it doesn't necessarily matter, and they're going to try and compete on price to some extent. In terms of white labeling is tricky. I think that I would probably get a good handle on just having them act as a reseller before I start going down the white labeling. Because with white labeling, you really want to be charging exponentially more. And until you know what you should be charging as a reseller, it's very difficult to know what you should be charging as a white label provider. So Dylan, hope that helps, and thanks for the question. Our next question comes from Marco Schwartz, and he says, "Hi, Mike and Rob. I've been following your podcast for about 3 months now, and I'm working on my own products, so I'm looking for a SaaS app idea. I am personally passionate about the restaurant business, so I'm thinking about building a web app for this business that would manage accounting, inventory, staff, etc., that would be priced for a monthly fee. I know it's not really a niche like you would advise in your podcast, but on the other side, I didn't find any SaaS apps online. I only found some very expensive $1,000 to $2,000 software packages to buy. Am I missing something? I'd love to have your opinion on this idea. Thanks."
So I don't think this is a terrible idea, but know upfront that this is going to be high touch sales. You are going to be doing outbound cold calls in the evenings because that's when restaurants are open, and or you're going to be paying in-person visits. I don't know anyone who makes a lot of these kinds of sales directly online using, you know, paid acquisition and Facebook ads and SEO and content marketing and that kind of stuff. Now, you mentioned a broad range of what your app might do. You said it would manage accounting, inventory, staff, etc. That is huge. I bet those packages that sell for $1,000 to $2,000 are massive and probably have 5 or 10-year-old code bases. And that's probably why they look so crappy, because they're written in an old technology. But I would bite off a much smaller piece of that and then try to expand outward at a minimum. But know that you are in for high-touch sales, that you're going to be dealing with people face-to-face, and I would personally go out and try to sell 10 copies of it first, or 10 subscriptions to it first, based on the idea, or based on mock-ups, or based on some designs, or just something, just to see what that feels like. Even if you get 10 no's, at least you're going to know what it's like to have a conversation with restaurant owners, and you're going to, you know, have an idea of how hard it is to talk to them and potentially sell. I would also suggest that you consider getting in touch with Brian Cassell, and he has a podcast called Bootstrapped Web, and he owns a product called Restaurant Engine, which is basically, think of it like Squarespace for restaurants. It helps them get their websites up and running. At least with Restaurant Engine, you can imagine that there are a certain amount of restaurants actively looking online for a new website, right? Looking for website templates and designs and stuff. So he has things he can tap into. What you're talking about is taking over their back office and handling accounting, inventory, staff. That's a more complex proposition. You're going to need a lot more credibility. It's going to be a challenge. You said, are you missing something? Yeah, I don't think it's as easy as perhaps as you've presented in this email. And I do think that before you write a line of code, there's a lot more, you know, feet on the ground research that probably needs to happen.
Yeah, I'll second what Rob said. I mean, the restaurant industry is, I'll say, technologically averse. So I've looked at this a little bit. There was a website that came up on Flippa a couple of years ago that was also in the restaurant space, but they weren't doing inventory or accounting or staff management or anything like that. The only thing that it was intended for was for allowing a restaurant to take orders online. And I forget how much it was selling for, but it was probably $2,000 or $3,000, and the price point was, I think, around $500 or $800 or something like that. And they were not getting very many sales. I think they were only getting one or two a month. So their revenue was reasonable. But what in talking to the owner of it, it turned out that there was a lot of high touch sales that went into that because everybody wanted customizations. Everyone wanted it to look like their own website. And then it came on to once they bought the software package, they wanted all these customizations, and then they wanted a whole website design. And it tended to turn more into consulting engagements than anything else. The different things that you talked about, the accounting, inventory, staff management, each one of those things could be its own software package because it's such a large problem that can be solved. So I might look at some of those. Maybe you're looking at a time tracker for restaurants or something like that because you want to be scheduling people to come in and work. And that might be something that you want to translate into, an online solution. But as Rob said, go talk to them. See if there are ways that you can figure out how they manage that problem now, whether or not they do use spreadsheets or just, you know, call people up and ask them what their times are. Maybe you can put together a package where people can say, these are the hours that I work, these are the hours that I don't work, and have the software package basically take the store hours and manage staffing the business based on, you know, who's going to be available and when they're not going to be available. So Marco, hope that helps. Thanks for the question. And our last question of the day is from Frank Anderson, and he says, "Hi guys, thanks as always for the inspiring and informative show. I'm building a SaaS app and have been looking at the various B2B app stores such as Salesforce and MailChimp. Do you guys have any experience or perspective on how helpful these can be in terms of getting traction with a new app? Would love to hear this discussed on the podcast. Thanks, Frank. And Rob, I think you had a specific term for this. You called it integration marketing?
That's right. Yeah, I mentioned this in my MicroConf talk this last year. So the answer is it depends. The real key to making this kind of thing work is that you get there an upfront buy-in that if you build something cool, you build a nice landing page, that they will do an email blast for you or a blog post or something like that. A tweet, maybe you build it, maybe you don't. But just to build it to be in the App Store and get a small trickle of recurring traffic every month, I tend to not do that. I'm not saying it never works out, but most of the time that doesn't work out. What's really nice if you're actually looking for establishing a sales channel and trying to get some early traction, some early customers, you need that initial blast to all of their customers. And so think a little bit smaller than Salesforce and MailChimp, because those are the ones that you can apply to and, you know, submit your app and you'll get in, but they're not going to email their customer base about you because you're a small fish compared to them. So as an example, with Hittail, when I started doing some integration marketing, I contacted some smaller SEO SaaS apps, some you may never heard of, like Authority Labs, which is a rank tracker. I actually contacted SEO Moz and wound up on theirs. You probably heard of them. But the larger ones, like we integrated Hittail with Basecamp, that one didn't do very well for us. And there were two reasons for that. The first is that, you know, they wouldn't agree up front to do any cut type of blast because they're just too big. And we knew that. But the integration itself wasn't very hard. And it was the first one we were doing. And we kind of just wanted to do it as a trial. The second reason it didn't work out super well is because the audiences don't exactly line up. And so you've named two services, Salesforce and MailChimp. Unless your audience really closely aligns with people who are using Salesforce and MailChimp, just because they have a lot of people using it doesn't mean that, you know, a lot of them are going to come use your app. And so with Basecamp, I mean, it's like a fraction of a percentage of people who come over who actually sign up for a trial. Whereas with SEO Moz and Authority Labs, those are at least 10 times the signup rate of the Basecamp integration. And so that's the first thing to think about is who can I find who's small enough that I can talk to the founder and it's not some big committee and I can say, you know, if I do this and do a really good job of it, are you willing to kind of email the audience and give me that initial kick? And the second thing is to think about which apps are out there whose audiences really closely align with the customers that you're seeking. So thanks for the question, Frank. I hope that's helpful. If you have a question or comment for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. See you next time.